Welcome to you all for what is the first of our seminars this term. Our next seminar is a week from today, on Thursday the 19th, Decoding Antisemitism, Hate Speech and Imagery Online. The speaker then will be Matthias Becker from the Technical University in Berlin, and that will be the first in a new series of seminars that we have on antisemitism now. Today I'm really, really thrilled to introduce our speaker, Gavin Schaffer from the University of Birmingham. Gavin is Professor of Modern British History there. He's the author of Racial Science and British Society, published in 2008, and The Vision of a Nation, published in 2014, and currently is writing something which is much needed, which is a post-war history of the British Jewish community. And I imagine it's from that work that he takes his paper today, Jewish-Christian Relations in Post-War Britain. Just before Gavin starts, I'll just ask you all if you can remain muted after after Gavin is finished. We'll have time for a Q&A. Please raise your hand, as it were, electronically, and I will be able to see if you have a comment or a question, and I'll then ask you to unmute yourselves. If you don't want to ask your question yourself, you can always put your question in the chat. But without anything more from me, I'll ask Gavin to begin. Gavin.
Thanks, David. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to speak to you today. And just running quickly through the list of participants, it's very nice to see friends from near and far. And, you know, it would be less weird to see you all personally, but I know for sure that then some of you definitely wouldn't be here. So this mechanism of communication has its advantages. Going to talk a little bit about Jewish-Christian relations as I see it, read this paper here, and then I'd be delighted to hear what you've got to say about it. So, relations in Britain between Jewish and Christian religious communities have changed significantly over the last century through a series of channels, local, national, international. Jews and Christians have partaken of dialogue and supported each other in a way which led the Church of England in its 2019 document, God's Unfailing Word, to speculate that Jewish-Christian engagement was now, and I quote, paradigmatic for all other interfaith relations. A desire for new terms of engagement in the wake of the Holocaust went some way to shape this new relationship. According to Rabbi Lionel Blue's analysis, the Holocaust and the last war shattered some bad things too. Religiously, both the hot war between Christians and Jews and the Cold War, which succeeded it, are dying too. And yet, change in Jewish-Christian relations, while undoubtedly catalyzed by the Holocaust, preceded both Nazi anti-Semitism and the resulting genocide. Groups such as the London Society for the Study of Religion from 1904, the Society of Jews and Christians from 1927 offer early examples. In the interwar period, efforts from a couple of deeply dedicated theologians, people like the Methodist William Simpson, the Anglican James Parks, kept pressure up for greater bonds. It was, though, amid the horror of the Second World War that Christian-Jewish relations really took off through the establishment in 1942 of the Council of Christians and Jews, CCJ. CCJ was formed at the initiative of the then Archbishop of York, William Temple, soon to be Archbishop of Canterbury, who invited Christian leaders and the chief rabbi to lunch in 1941 after extensive lobbying by Parks and Simpson. The aims of the council were not specifically focused on anti-Semitism, but rather it established a broader remit to check and combat religious and racial intolerance and promote mutual understanding and goodwill. This reflected a Christian comprehension of Nazism, which saw the persecution of Jews as symptomatic of an even deeper evil and crisis. Specifically, church leaders saw in Nazi attacks on dissenting Christian churchmen a risk to their own position, so that in the words of Anne Summers, they considered that the sufferings of Jews and Christians in Germany were inextricably interconnected. Efforts towards an international council of Christians and Jews began in 1946 after a meeting in Oxford. And there again, anti-Semitism didn't take center stage, though in subsequent meetings in Seelisburg and Freiburg, it did. Again, though, revulsion towards Nazism in the thinking of the organizers and delegates was highly significant. After all, as Wagoda has pointed out, three delegates of the first conference in Oxford, this is the conference of what would become the International Council, were themselves survivors of Nazi concentration camps. The decision not to foreground publicly the fight against anti-Semitism in CCJ and ICCJ is interesting. In many ways, as Cardinal Heenan explained in 1972, the goal of fighting anti-Semitism was so central and obvious to these groups that it was perverse not to name it. CCJ was not founded, Heenan argued, to protect the Christians from the Jew, and nobody thinks it was. It was founded to protect Jews from the Christian. And yet, speaking 30 years after CCJ's establishment, Heenan's claim caused consternation, deviating as it did from the original script. It was, Simpson reprimanded Heenan, too negative in its implications, and it tended to bore people when it's always the Jew that we're standing up for. And here in a nutshell was perhaps the primary reason why CCJ had never defined itself in terms of anti-Semitism. In the early 1940s, Christian leaders feared for their own communities in the face of the Nazi onslaught. And meanwhile, supporters of Jewish refugees and Jewish community were wary of accusations of special pleading amid an atmosphere of British anti-Semitism, which was quick to see Jews as demanding support ahead of ordinary Britons. CCJ was no marriage of equals. This was well understood. Faced with the reality of Jewish marginality and Christian dominance, Jews were to be the recipients of help, but it was unseemly to say so, and risked undermining the nascent atmosphere of interfaith brotherhood. Far better to point out, as Chief Rabbi Hertz did, that the Nazi challenge posed a broader threat to the whole nation in terms of the utter repudiation of the sacredness of human life. This position, in any case, resonated with the worldview of the Church of England, which, according to Tom Lawson, cast Nazism as the antithesis of civilization and Christianity more than as the destroyer of European Jewry. But there's little doubt, as per the thinking of Heenan, that Christian desire to repent anti-Semitism supported the growth of interfaith relations in post-war Europe and North America. After the Holocaust, it didn't take long for significant statements about anti-Semitism to emerge from a range of national and international bodies, such as the World Council of Churches First Assembly in 1948. Eventually, such statements set new parameters of Jewish-Christian relations, change epitomized in the Catholic Church's Nostra Aetate statement of 1965. In what Cardinal Heenan would go on to articulate as a reparation to the Jewish people, Nostra Aetate laid out clearly Catholic opposition to hatred, persecution, displays of anti-Semitism directed against Jews at any time by anyone. This was a statement that had firm roots in the Holocaust. As the guidance for implementation notes explained, Nostra Aetate found its historical setting in circumstances deeply affected by the memory of the persecution and massacre which took place in Europe just before and during the Second World War. This evolving church position highlighted a slowly growing awareness that Nazi anti-Semitism had its roots in the charges laid against the Jews in early Christian texts, specifically in allegations of deicide. As God's unfailing word explained in 2019, the Gospels, and in particular their passion narratives, were routinely interpreted in ways that reinforced this charge of collective guilt. Nostra Aetate, while still maintaining that the Jewish authorities and those who followed their lead pressed for the death of Christ, argued that what happened in his passion cannot be charged against all the Jews without distinction, then alive, nor against the Jews of today. This modest statement was a giant leap for the church and allowed for an international reconsideration of the Passion of Christ and the Jewish role within it. In the post-war period, Christian engagement against anti-Semitism could entail promoting this kind of interpretation, pressing churches not to demonize the Jewish historical past in a way which might provoke anti-Semitism. For example, one case taken on by CCJ involved remonstrating with a minister in Surrey who had banned in his church certain readings from the Old Testament, telling the press that they were horrible stuff, wherein the Israelites were instructed by their repulsive war god to massacre innocent people. The minister, who went on to describe Zionism as the present scourge of the Middle East and said that the Passover story was revolting and unhistorical, was swiftly challenged by Christian leaders in CCJ. Writing to him personally, Simpson criticized the scriptural analysis as unnecessarily offensive and reflecting little understanding of the nature of both Jewish and Christian belief. Perhaps he counseled, instead of pretending that the behavior of Jews in the Old Testament was worse than the behavior of non-Jews nowadays, it might be more productive to reflect on the text as a picture of how man does, in fact, behave, as well as how he should. This challenge reflected a pattern of CCJ action, whereby Christian leaders used their authority to stand up on behalf of Jewish people. In most post-war cases, the issues at hand were not primarily theological. CCJ activists spoke out against anti-Semitic characterization in children's books. They petitioned foreign governments about their treatment of Jewish communities. And they even challenged BBC Radio 4 over its decision to invite the widow of Oswald Mosley onto Desert Island Discs. When the RSPCA, the Royal Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, called for the banning of Shechita, CCJ's Christian leaders visited abattoirs to witness the practice so that they could advocate for its ethical and humane nature. For Jewish members, these kinds of actions were hugely significant. Writing to the chief rabbi in 1980, Leonard Goss, who was joint chief executive officer of CCJ at that time, said that there are Christians ready to take up at least verbal and written cudgels on behalf of Jewry in many regards is important. What they say and write has more effect upon non-Jews than anything that could be said by Jews. Although much of the impetus for the new Jewish-Christian relations epitomized in CCJ was political, it was also underwritten by an evolving theological position concerning the history, role, and destiny of Judaism as perceived from a Christian viewpoint. These changes served a dual function, allowing Christians to see Judaism in a more positive light, but also enabling religious Jews to feel that they could take part in dialogue without compromising core values. Specifically, it was a shift that allowed for the Christian comprehension of Judaism as an alternative path to God. In this way, as an Anglican church document put it in 1988, Jews were not to be seen as a living fossil, simply superseded by Christianity. Instead, it was increasingly accepted among Christians that the ancient covenant between Jews and God held firm, notwithstanding the Jewish rejection of Christ. As Nostra Aetate explained, God holds the Jews most dear for the sake of their fathers. He does not repent of the gifts he makes or the calls he issues. Here, Jewish people have their own covenant, their own relationship with God, and their own path to salvation. As draft guidelines on Jewish Christian relations issued by the World Council of Churches outlined in 1978, we maintain that as a separate and specific people, the Jews are an instrument of God with a particular divinely appointed task. This evolving Christian position was no mere matter of theological niceties or semantics. What it offered was recognition that Jewish people didn't need to be saved by Christians or Christianity, and that the correct theological approach towards Jewish people and faith should be one of respect and dialogue. This mattered firstly because it offered a path away from church anti-Semitism, which had often been rooted in the idea that in their rejection of Christ, Jewish people had voided their covenant with God. But it mattered more still because two covenant theology removed or at least significantly reduced this justification for Christian missioning to Jews. And without a doubt, the fear of Christian proselytizing had been, from the Jewish side, the key stumbling block in the way of Jewish-Christian dialogue. Still is. For the representative of Britain's Jewish community, representatives of British Jewish community, any equivocation in this matter was highly problematic. What Jewish religious leaders wanted was a clear promise from all Christian churches that Jewish people would never again be seen as subjects for conversion. Unfortunately, for many Christians, this was no simple commitment to give. The matter has indeed remained sufficiently controversial so as even to muddy the waters of that 2019 Anglican document, God's Unfailing Word. Here, despite an overall atmosphere of positivity, Chief Rabbi Mervis uses his afterword to rail against the Anglican Church for failing to take a firm line on missioning, arguing that such behavior could destroy Jewish-Christian dialogue and cooperation. He said, "It's as though we are jointly building an essential new structure while simultaneously a small part of the construction team is deliberately destabilizing the building's foundations." For the leaders of British church, Christians and Christian interfaith activists, some practices were easier to rule out than others. Faced with allegations that organizations such as the US imported Jews for Jesus were targeting vulnerable people and deceiving Jews into Christian life, it was simple enough to say that such practices were beyond the pale, as well as to argue that no specific community should be targeted by missionaries. For James Parks and for thinkers like him, the approach taken was that Jewish people should be left to their own covenant and that the rest could be deferred to God. This was no denial of an ultimate belief in the unification, in unification through Christ, only a recognition that any such attempts in contemporary society were premature. In Parks's parlance, the reunification of Jews and Christians would come by God's will, but this would occur, quote, at some point in the future. It is beyond my planning. Here, Parks and others could follow Paul's insistence that the salvation of Israel would precede the second coming. In this way, as Wagoda has explained, even amid the ostensible abandonment of active mission, the hope for Jewish acceptance of Jesus as part of God's destiny for the world remained built into Christian eschatology, a useful theological cop-out. Jewish separation could be seen in this way as a window into and barometer of messianic return. The World Council of Churches report into the church and Jewish people explained in this way that the view of some Christians that God had linked to the final hope of the world to the salvation of the Jews would mean that he would come in the day when he will heal the broken body of his one people, Israel, and the church. In the meantime, Christians, instead of aiming to persuade Jews of the messianic authenticity of Jesus, sometimes rearticulated their responsibility in terms of serving as witnesses to Christ in their interactions with Jews and everybody else. The idea here, former Anglican Archbishop of Jerusalem George Appleton explained, was to allow Jewish people to see Jesus in the lives of those who came to be his disciples without feeling that they were being got at. The problem with these evolving Christian perspectives, so far as Jewish-Christian relations were concerned, were twofold. Firstly, while it would be wrong to dismiss theological changes insignificant, many Jews remained wary of the ultimate underlying message and were still inclined to hear calls that they should turn to Christ, even when these were expressed in quiet voices. After all, the idea that Christ would ultimately bring the world together at one, albeit as a future point, did not much recede in most Christian thinking and thus continued what was perceived by many Jews to be an age-old Christian threat to the integrity of Jewish faith. The other problem, of course, was that some Christians, even within mainstream churches, did not accept the sidestepping or softening of evangelism, seeing it as a core part of their faith and duty. This was recognized as a valid point of view by the leadership of the Anglican Church, who would not and still will not exclude or proscribe those who see the conversion of Jews as desirable and necessary. Thus, in an Anglican paper on Jewish, Christian and Muslim relations in 1988, the idea that Jews did not require conversion was expressed as one possible opinion rather than official policy. In the same year, the correspondence between the CCJ's Jim Richardson with the Bishop of Taunton, Nigel McCulloch, about the church's upcoming decade of evangelism neatly illustrates the problem. Richardson asked McCulloch, who was chair of the church's decade of evangelism steering group, to recognize that mission was, quote, a word that sends shivers of fear and resentment down the spines of many who have come to God by a different route other than Christianity, and who do not see in the gospel and church history any good news at all. McCulloch replied, "Whilst agreeing that mission may send shivers down the spines of those who have come to God by a different route than Christianity, I do not want the Church of England or the other denominations involved alongside us to shy away from the clear call to mission and evangelism and proclaiming the good news, which is at the very heart of the Christian gospel." This was a problem that had been present since the outset of CCJ. When Temple became Archbishop of Canterbury, Parkes urged him to decline to act, as was traditional, as the patron of the church's mission to the Jews. In response, Temple argued that he would do no such thing. He said, "I do not think I could interpret my interest in promoting Christian-Jewish friendship as in any way precluding an equal interest in attempting to convert Jews, because that does appear to me to be a Christian obligation. And if I had to choose, it would take precedence over the other." So, while numerous Christian theologians worked incredibly hard to render Christianity more palatable and less threatening to Jewish communities, many Jewish leaders and activists continued to hear proselytizing undertones in a way that undermined interfaith cooperation. For some Jewish leaders and activists, the issue really problematized the desirability of growing contacts between the faiths. For example, Birmingham's Rabbi Shmuel Arkush, who in the 1980s led a campaign called Operation Judaism to protect Jewish people, and especially students and vulnerable groups, from indoctrination by missionaries, alienated local and national CCJ supporters when he admitted that he felt uncertain when Christian people tried to befriend him and believed that an underlying commitment to mission was fundamental to Christian doctrine. To his mind, Arkush argued, any Christian who says he doesn't believe in missionary activities is a hypocrite. Mission, he felt, was so central to the faith that, and I quote, "in a way, if a Christian says, let's be friends, I find it sticks in the gullet." Arkush's remarks drew a flurry of criticism from CCJ and beyond. A CCJ statement asserted that views of this kind could undermine the work we are doing just as much as missionary bodies. And within parts of Jewish communities, Arkush's comments similarly didn't land well. The president of Birmingham Singers Hill Orthodox congregation wrote to Lord Coggan at CCJ to disassociate himself from Arkush's views, as did the chief rabbi. Arkush felt that his comments had been taken out of context, but his position perhaps better represented much of Jewish thinking than he or the leaders who had disassociated themselves from his remarks cared to admit. Arkush himself went on to argue some years later that all the organizations that are set up to break down barriers between Jew and Gentile, all they have done is to soften up the ground for the missionaries. Whether or not one gets involved in interfaith work, he contested, was a question for rabbinic ruling. And here he drew attention to the ruling of Rabbi Soloveitchik. And this is Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik, who helped to generate the guidelines on interfaith developed by the Orthodox Rabbinical Council of America, which concluded that discussions between faith communities should only take place where they excluded theological matters. And this was, generally speaking, the position also taken by Britain's chief rabbi in the period, Emmanuel Jacobowitz. Reporting Jacobowitz's stance on interfaith, the tablet explained that the chief rabbi only accepted the validity of religious discussion between faiths where it affected another group. Otherwise, it said, no kind of theological discussion is acceptable to him. Interfaith services, real theological discussion, he rejects. So that's not real theological discussion, real theological dialogue. Indeed, this Jewish stance had shaped the evolution of CCJ from the beginning. The organization could not directly evolve from the earlier society of Christians and Jews because the then chief rabbi Hertz had strongly criticized any form of religious fraternization and had threatened to resign from CCJ at the outset in 1942 when he feared it might involve sharing theological education and become something of a, quote, society for spiritual intermarriage. Jews were not the only party wary of blurring the integral boundaries of their faiths. Under advice from Rome, Cardinal Hinsey had shared the chief rabbi's stance at CCJ's birth, and Cardinal Griffiths led the Catholic group out of the organization in 1954, citing anxieties about indifferentism, though they were to return 10 years later in a different papal atmosphere. Yet concerns about religious blurring were disproportionately Jewish. On the Christian side, there was a fairly consistent hope that engaging with Jewish theology and practice might enrich Christian faith. As Bishop Appleton explained in a published letter to a Jewish friend, we Christians need the help of Jews in understanding the Jewishness of Jesus and so be enabled to appreciate his significance and the relevance of his teaching more deeply. The idea that religious enrichment could be achieved through interfaith engagement never really took hold on the Jewish side outside of progressive forms of Judaism. So how then should we understand Jewish engagement with organizations like CCJ? Well, the first part of this answer relates to the growing importance ascribed by some Jewish leaders to broader faith coalitions on moral and ethical issues in post-war society. Jewish theologians could entirely share the trepidation and alarm felt by other religious people when faced with the permissive secular turn that society seemed to be taking from the 1960s. The idea of shared moral responsibility between faiths was paramount in the thinking of Chief Rabbi Emanuel Jacobowitz. The contemporary world, he thought, needed religious leaders to come together in order to address the evils and immorality rampant in our society. According to Jacobowitz's thinking, the priority was to establish, quote, if not religious ecumenism, at least moral ecumenism. This model of engagement then provided a Jewish framework for Christian-Jewish relations to develop, although it was not, of course, a relationship between equals. Jews had to accept a greater amount of theological discussion than was comfortable for some in return for a broader set of benefits. As Wagoda has put it, Jews were forced to talk religion when they meant social betterment. To sweeten the pill, Jewish-Christian relations had become one of the few areas of prosperous cooperation between Orthodox and progressive Jews in Britain. Through a consultative committee, Jewish religious leaders managed to come together to support this work in a way they found difficult in other arenas. And I think this was precisely because the matters arising from Jewish-Christian relations were largely non-theological from a Jewish point of view, and also perhaps more cynically because Orthodox Jews could see the sense in allowing their progressive brethren to take the lead when it came to getting hands dirty when interfaith theology couldn't entirely be avoided. Inviting Rabbi Nachum Rabinowitz, the principal of Jews College, to join the consultative committee, Moshe Davis, from the chief rabbi's office, explained how the group had diffused some situations between ourselves and the progressives. This was, he confided, one of the unspoken reasons for its formation. Jewish-Christian relations, at least to a great extent, were thus valuable to Jewish leaders as well as to Christian, although the issue of mission continued to irritate. But even on the agreed set of terms, beyond theology, problems could and did occur, nowhere more so than regarding the appropriate response to conflict between Israel and the Palestinians. Here, the limits of Jewish-Christian moral unity were tested, exposing long-standing ethnic and religious rivalries, unequal power, and a rising Christian concern that concessions within interfaith engagement might be largely one-sided. To most British Jews after the Holocaust, Israel was seen as offering a badly needed sanctuary for Jewish people fleeing oppression. It also became a new source of Jewish pride and self-confidence, especially after the Arab-Israeli Six-Day War of 1967. All in all, Israel and Zionism came to assume a big part of identity for many Jewish Britons, who thus expected from new Christian friends support and understanding. Some Christian leaders, especially within CCJ, well understood this hunger for support. For example, when the World Council of Churches discussion of the church took place in 1966, they acknowledged that Israel was, quote, of tremendous importance for the great majority of Jews, having provided a new feeling of self-assurance and security which the Gentile world had failed to give them. Speaking up for Israel, however, was not entirely easy for some Christian leaders and was seen as increasingly undesirable by others. For one thing, many Christian leaders felt a need to represent and defend their Arab Christian brethren in Israel, constituencies that were often hostile to and marginalized by the Israeli state. To some Jews, this kind of equivocation was exasperating. Writing after the Yom Kippur War, the director of the World Zionist Organization railed against the sympathetic, even against the sympathetic CCJ position on Israel. As far as he was concerned, CCJ was showing no sensitivity whatsoever to Jewish life and fate and was an alibi for inaction and indifference. Jewish insistence on CCJ support for Israel and Jewish criticism where it was perceived that such support was insufficiently clear or lacking illuminates the priorities and principles of Jewish engagement with interfaith work in this period. For many Jewish leaders and activists, if interfaith work was to be worth the effort and compromise, it needed to support the well-being of Jews at home and abroad, making them safer and more secure in Christian societies. This stance added up to something rather less than an interfaith brotherhood, more perhaps a marriage of convenience. The Christian side too had its own agendas and drivers. After the Holocaust, engagement with Jews was frequently underpinned by a desire to repent for the crimes committed by Nazis following Christian precedents of anti-Semitism. And yet the Nazi genocide was, as Tom Lawson has pointed out, as frequently remembered by the church as a crime of non-Christian others, an attack on Christianity and Christian values. What was often sought in invoking the Holocaust was thus not so much the forgiveness of Jews for Christian transgressions, as the creation of a shared victimhood and a desire to build community to avoid future attacks by similar unholy forces. All in all, then, interfaith activity was not so much a spiritual or moral coming together as a mutually agreeable sharing of benefits. At a high level, British religious bodies were corporate entities which, to Lionel Blue's mind, regarded each other like modern multinationals, beady and calculatedly, competing not for consumers but for souls. On these terms, Shmuel Arkush's cynicism regarding Jewish-Christian friendships, while embarrassing and inconvenient for those active in interfaith at the time, perhaps reflected something of a reality that both sides were keen to ignore. Christians were primarily interested in Jews as figures that might strengthen their own faith, and Jews were not interested in Christians at all, except insofar as they might need them for political and social protection. Wigoda's description of pre-war Jewish-Christian discussion as not dialogue, but a double monologue, speaks compellingly for the post-war too. Where interfaith relations did make ground and offer mutual benefit was in the political sphere. Despite differing goals and competing interests, Jews and Christians in post-war Britain could recognise each other as allies against secularism and permissiveness, an alliance built up by Emmanuel Jacobowitz perhaps more than anyone else. Under pressure from those who desired the removal of traditional moral strictures from British society, Jews and Christians indeed had common ground to defend. Those who really sought deeper interfaith dialogue, however, walked a tightrope, exposed to allegations of indifferentism amid a lingering concern that the core principles of each faith could be eroded by contact with the other. Seeking out a spiritual shared space was mostly dismissed as a desecration of faith and tradition, especially but not only on the Jewish side. As Lionel Blue put it, the no man's land which separates all faiths are not pleasant places, and the most desolate of them all was the no man's land which separated Judaism and Christianity. Then and now, interfaith relations made progress by limiting contact in the no man's land, as both sides generally maintained a dignified distance. If Jewish-Christian relations offered a model of interfaith, it is on these terms, as each party recognised that good fences made good neighbours, and that the quest for unity between Christianity and Judaism indeed remained, as Parks had once put it, beyond the planning of man. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that paper, Gavin. Really, really fascinating. And I have scores of questions, and I'll just restrict my privilege as the chair just to asking two of them. So one question, and And before I do so, I'll ask people, if you do have a question, please do raise your hand or put your question in the chat. So one question, Gavin, is simply that you tended to talk about Christians as a job lot. And so I just wondered whether it would be, it's in any way helpful to differentiate there. Even, I imagine, inside of Anglicanism, whether sort of some wings found it harder to give up on missionizing than others. And then the second question comes, in a way, it's suggested by thinking about 19th century developments. And in a sense, there was greater cooperation between some churches over education, for example, and between Jews and the churches over education, in the face of what was perceived to be a growing godlessness of society in the second half of the 19th century. And so I wondered whether Christians and Jews found any common ground for action in response to what was often figured as the rise of the permissive society.
Well, the second question simply is yes. That is the common ground.
Okay.
That you as Emmanuel Jacobovitz put it, it's this search for moral ecumenism. Ecumenism is not really a word between faiths, but I get his point because it's a moral ecumenism. So, you know, yes, issues around divorce, abortion, more meaty issues related to the way that the church, the state taxes religious bodies. There were a whole variety of issues in which it was incredibly easy for Jews and Christians to find that they agreed almost entirely with each other. Though that is somewhat undermined by your first question, which is, of course, there's Christians and Christians and Jews and Jews. So, you know, what you do tend to get is you do tend to get a particular type of, but because what you've said about difference between Christians, David, holds equally well within the Jewish community. You know, there's a particular type of Jewish person that tends to be involved in interfaith work, not always, but usually. It tends to be people on the progressive side of Judaism, though there are some very notable exceptions. And so, you know, but maybe it is worth discussing more on that Christian side, because you have everything ranging from evangelical Christian Zionists all the way through the really liberal side of the Anglican Church and to the left of that. And of course, there's a world of difference between those groups, but it produces strange fruit when it comes to the way they deal with Jews. And you especially see that play out in Israel-Palestine, that you don't know what you're going to get. And I think it's fair to say that within organizations like CCJ and ICCJ, again, you get a particular type of Christian theologian, and it tends not to be that kind of evangelical type.
Thank you, Gavin. Very interesting. Todd Enderman, you have a question. Why don't you unmute yourself?
Okay. I found this fascinating, Gavin. I'm wondering how deeply into the clergy of Britain these concerns spread. In other words, when we talk about interfaith relations, are we really just talking about a discussion among a very, very small group of people? Or are these concerns that really motivate large numbers of Jews and Christians? Because I can imagine a large number of Jews were concerned about Christian evangelism, but that had always been true. And there were many other issues that were up for discussion. And were these just theological matters that, while genuine, didn't reflect the concerns of widespread groups of Jews and Christians?
Thanks, Todd. It's really nice to hear your voice, Todd.
Thank you.
Let's play it backwards. The Rabbi Arkush's campaign in the 1980s, Operation Judaism, brings out hundreds of Jews in public meetings and really does create a stir. There's something about, there were a couple of high profile cases in the late 70s and early 80s of kind of quite sort of, how can we put it, quite forceful Christian groups aiming at Jewish conversion, and a couple of leading to a couple of horrible outcomes. So Arkush's campaign, it really strikes a chord. And your guess would know more than me about what it is that really does resonate, but it really does. So in a meeting he holds in Stamor, my old stomping ground, in the late 1980s, he gets nearly 500 people turning up for a public meeting. In another London meeting, he gets over 1,000. You know, there's something going on in the Jewish community that responds particularly sharply to concerns about mission. That is altogether different to Jewish interest in interfaith dialogue, which I'd say is much more limited. On the Christian side, I think there is a broader interest. I think, obviously you know that there are CCJ groups all over the country. They have local organizations. And I do think that the Christian engagement is quite passionate. And I think that is both because there is a desire to reach out to Jews after the Holocaust, but I think also because it is increasingly understood that Judaism can play a role in helping Christians develop their faith. So you get things like lots of Christians taking an interest in Seder services, wanting to put on Seder services to better understand kind of the Christ's devotion. And I do think that kind of interest means that there's more interest on the Christian side than on the Jewish.
Thank you.
Thank you, Gavin. Susan Wolf, would you like to unmute and ask your question?
Hi, thank you. I'm American living in London, American Reform Jewish living in London, and attended a gazillion years ago a very progressive American university, the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And I always remember somebody who lived in the dorm, this woman knocking on my door, standing at my door and saying, just to say, Susan, don't you think Judaism is a step backwards? And I just sort of quietly closed the door. But was this sort of thing happening at English British universities with like Campus Crusade for Christ? You know, this sort of thing.
So
is that happening here?
Thank you, Susan, for your question. The answer is, I think, yes, it was happening. Quite how widespread it was, I'm still not quite sure. So there were things, and I say this comes back to Rabbi Arkush and Operation Judaism. Operation Judaism begins more than anything else as a challenge to support Jews on campus. There are also special chaplaincy boards set up to support Jews on campus. And those decisions are taken because of the fear of exactly the kind of thing you are talking about. Quite how widespread it was, I'm not clear. But what is absolutely clear is that the Jewish community in that period is incredibly worried about it. So is it happening? Yes. How widely is it happening? I'm not sure.
Thank you.
Thanks. Gavin, we have a question in the chat from Paul Mersch, who says, to return to what David said, could you say what you mean by a Christian?
Yeah, no, I don't think I'll do that, Paul.
Okay.
I think that's well beyond my my theological competence. I'm very happy to talk about whether Paul thinks that the term is problematic in some way and why, but I won't. I'm not going to define that. And then I can see Anne Summers' question as well.
Yes, I'll relay that. So Anne says or writes, on Gavin's reference to Christians wanting to learn from Judaism, in my experience, Roman Catholics often want to learn more about the Old Testament, which they hadn't been brought up on, which is a very interesting question.
Yeah, it is. It's a very good point, Anne. And thank you for the article that you've just written, which has been incredibly helpful to me.
Helen, Elisa, you have a question or a comment that you'd like to make. You have to unmute yourself, Helen.
Yeah. I don't know whether this is an appropriate question, because I haven't studied religious history, although I had Jewish grandparents on one side and Christian on the other. I couldn't help noticing that all the people that you referred to in your talk were men. And I just wondered whether there's any difference in the attitudes of the Christian faith and the Jewish community towards gender relationships that might have had some sort of impact on cooperation and attitudes to one or the other in the post-war period.
Oh, that's a fantastic question, Helen, and I thank you for the observation. I think the fact that the kind of leaders of these organizations are men says much about society and the way that leadership happens in that period, and you know, about the kind of structural inequalities that continue. There is pioneering work or on kind of interfaith work by people like Lily Montague, or on the Jewish side, who really have a substantial impact. But I think if you want to look for the impact of women, you'd do well to start by digging in a slightly different place, away from those kind of center of the institution histories where I've kind of been looking. I was just having a conversation with a colleague yesterday about how interfaith relations look really different at the level of the personal, that actually a lot of the things that we get stuck on at kind of institutional level because the person who is representing the Anglican Church at a specific moment cannot commit to the whole Anglican Church believing a specific line on this, can be really taken much further at those kind of local and personal levels. And I reckon if you dug there, you would find a much more gender balanced history. So thank you for the challenge. I think it's a good one.
Thank you.
Thanks, Gavin. I'm actually going to ask Anne Summers, who has written on some of these issues, whether you'd like to add anything on the sort of gender, a dimension of interfaith relations and dialogue, and who engages in it and how they engage in it.
Oh, well, thank you. Plugging my book, Christian and Jewish Women in Britain, 1880 to 1940, I find it quite remarkable how easily Jewish and Christian women of a certain class, middle and upper class, the Jewish women to some extent assimilated, having been to secular schools, but having nevertheless remained often intensely religious, had very little difficulty in discussing social issues and moral issues with their female Christian counterparts. And perhaps the most interesting example of this is the suffrage movement, because uniquely in this country, you had religious suffrage leagues, and they really did hold ecumenical gatherings. But there wasn't much of a forum for them after the war, which is when Lily Montague started the Society of Jews and Christians. But as she came from the new liberal synagogue. This was, you know, an absolute no-no for the mainstream, and of course, male-dominated Jewish synagogue religion. But the suffrage movement was quite extraordinary and very, very welcoming to the Jewish League for Woman Suffrage. The Catholic League was told after the war by the Vatican that they couldn't call themselves that. I mean, there were lots of reasons why nobody could take it that much further. And it's obvious why an initiative from the liberal synagogue for interfaith relations would not go very much further. But yes, there was an extraordinary amount of interaction. And with Zionism, you see Rebecca Seif and her Women's International Zionist Organization, or Federation of Women Zionists in this country, going out to meetings of the Women's Cooperative Guild, talking to them about Israel, getting support for the idea. As you say, local and grassroots, and very personal. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Anne.
And that's really interesting. Alan Walker has a question. If you'd like to unmute yourself, Alan.
Yeah, hi. Perhaps more, I feel like, I'm not sure if I have a question, it might turn into a question. I'm an Anglican clergyman, and I was until recently vicar of a parish where the Jewish population was larger than the Christian population, however that is defined, but certainly in terms of the census results. And I was also chairman of the local CCJ branch some time ago. I suppose my first observation is picking up, I think, what Anne Summers was saying about local initiatives. We had the local reform synagogue when it was being built, met in a local church, not my church, but met in a local church. The local Orthodox community, or part of the local Orthodox community, actually took over our church hall for use for Sabbath worship. So I think, you know, simply in terms of how this would appear to the local community, I think, you know, it demonstrates local initiatives and friendships. I found the talk absolutely fascinating because it also didn't, I mean, it's quite right that those initiatives that I'm observing, I didn't think really led to any great desire for theological debate and discussion, although they're very certainly, you know, expressed and created very strong further bonds of friendship, I think. And I thought it was just worth making that little observation. Also what I found very, very helpful was I'm no longer working in a parish, and I've gone back to kind of studying in academia and things, and I'm actually working on something a bit tangential to this, which is to do with the church's response, and I might now start thinking about adding the Jewish response as well, to so-called religious cults and new religious movement in modern times. And so just to comment on the business about, you know, missionary activity in universities, which I found very, very interesting. I know when I was working in a university, it was very difficult to, we tried to introduce a code of conduct because what we were concerned about was so-called, I also have to say so-called and wave my fingers around for inverted commas with religious cults, because definition of a cult is really a religion you don't like or something. But, you know, we wanted to introduce a code of conduct because these organizations would often disguise who they were. But certainly in terms of knocking on doors and being active in halls of residence, that was something there was a lot of concern about. But trying to get the evangelical Christian unions on our side, this is the point about divided Christians, was terribly difficult because they thought knocking on doors to spread the gospel was kind of absolutely central to their, you know, to their self-understanding. And, you know, they wouldn't stop doing it just because we were trying to introduce a code of conduct to, you know, to stop or to control in some way. We didn't want to stop or control. It was just what was a respectable way of behaving, what was an acceptable and appropriate way of behaving in institutions. So it's very long-winded, but it's, I think it expresses my gratitude and great interest in the gratitude to Gavin and great interest in the talk.
No, thank you very much, Alan. And I think the point you make about the end, about the kind of campuses, is really interesting. And I've seen in the archives this exact conversation play out exactly as you lay it out, about kind of codes of conduct being developed, anxieties about what local kind of very enthusiastic young Christians are doing. And my personal feeling, and I kind of said, was saying this to Todd, and it I'm trying to tease it out a little bit in my own thinking, is I think it's necessary to understand why Jewish communities, or why some people in the Jewish community, find that quite so threatening. At some level, the answer is obvious, but at some level, it isn't quite. And I am trying to kind of work it through. But what I would say is that those kind of groups are demonized in a way which I'm not sure is quite fair. You know, I don't want to get this wrong, but I think, yeah, one of the most prominent leaders of Jews for Jesus goes to a CCJ meeting, and what he asks them to do is to recognize his religious sincerity. Mm-hmm. And I end up thinking that's entirely fair enough. Like, don't construct me as kind of like a bogeyman who's just trying to do these you know, sneaky things. This is a sincere religious thing, which would lend itself to your point about, you know, the way we disparage small religions or new religious orders very easily, because it's convenient to us. So, I mean, there are very good reasons for what, well, you know, there are ample reasons why the Jewish community worries about this sort of thing. But I've ended up thinking that it would be well worth my time trying to think through a little bit more what those anxieties are and why they're quite as pronounced.
Thank you. Because this was new to me, the rabbi in Birmingham you were talking about in the 80s, is it possible to just put his name in the chat?
So yeah, that's Rabbi Arkush. Arkush, and as I say, Rabbi Arkush, who still lives and works in Birmingham, runs Operation Judaism, which is active. I'd need to check my dates, but active kind of through the 80s, and pretty much its primary aim is to kind of support the Jewish community to withstand missionary activities, especially when it comes to campuses.
Yeah. Fascinating. And there's something written about that? Is there a handy place I could go to learn more?
Yeah, watch this space.
Watch your book.
Launch. I'd just like to ask you one more question, Gavin, which is to say that the emphasis at the beginning of your talk was really on the Holocaust as an event which made people think there needed to be a change in Christian-Jewish relations, and the Holocaust and its legacy becomes a sort of a motor of the history that you're telling. Zionism is something which came into your lecture in different ways as a point of disruption.
Yeah.
In Christian-Jewish relations because of what was going on in Israel-Palestine. It's really a question which occurs to me is there a sense in which the ways in which Zionism became hegemonic in the Jewish community after the Second World War also had an impact on Christian-Jewish relations, that missionizing, I think, as you've said and others have said, was always looked on very darkly by the Jewish community. But I just wonder whether the rise of Zionism as a point of consensus in the community added another layer of repudiation as a sort of as an expression of Jewish pride, if you like.
Well, I mean, I think it all depends on your vantage point, David. I mean, for some Christian groups, the kind of Jewish return to Israel is kind of signposting and hinting towards all kinds of, you know, spiritual developments. You know, that this is this is divine providence. You know, this is God's plan in action.
I meant more from the Jewish standpoint, Gavin.
I think from the Jewish standpoint, the logical thing to suggest was that would be that the kind of increased confidence that is felt through that kind of Jewish nationalism might soften anxieties. I don't see it. I think what's interesting in the relationship between the two, between the Holocaust and Zionism, is that there are a specific set of national churches, as you might imagine, European specifically, that because of shame and repentance of the Holocaust, take on a much more pro-Zionist position than some other churches do, who come from backgrounds where they don't feel a primary responsibility.
Yes.
For the Holocaust, like sort of African churches, Asian churches, where they're just like, you know, this is awful, but it really isn't.
Yeah, that's very interesting.
You know, so you do begin to get, and understanding the infighting in the churches, a lot of that is about the geographical specificity of where the church groups are.
Well, thank you very much. We are out of time, but I'd like to thank everyone who has come along and who has contributed to what has been a really fascinating discussion. But above all, I'd like to thank our speaker, Gavin Schaffer, for really a wonderful, stimulating, rich, eye-opening paper. Thank you very much indeed, Gavin.
Thank you for having me.
I hope, and just as a last word, just to remind you that we have another seminar on hate speech and imagery online, this time next week. Same times, same. And never mind, I'll skip that Batman reference and just wish you all a very good afternoon. Thank you, and bye-bye.